See, hope is aspirational. Hope is this thing that is going to propel us into days we don't otherwise want to walk into. Hope says, this is not yet here. It's a yet to come. It's a one day soon. We're going to get there. But gratitude says, right now, if nothing changed, there would still be something worth celebrating. Gratitude's a superpower that allows us to sit in the present and to be grateful, to be thankful for what's there. And it allows us to be present to people so we can see their pain and we can see the opportunity we have to step into that pain. That's why gratitude is so important, because it focuses you on right here and right now, even in this room. Be here right now, right?
On the evening of April 14th, 2019, the Country Bookshelf was filled top to bottom with an enthusiastic crowd who came to hear John Pavlovitz speak about his work and his latest book, Hope and Other Superpowers, published by Simon & Schuster. It was part of MSU's The Compassion Project, a nonpartisan, non-religious organization and project that is designed to bring the Bozeman community and the greater Gallatin County together through education in and outside the schools around compassion, what it means, how to recognize it, how to practice it, and why it is important. John Pavlovitz is introduced by Kate Kaminsky, the executive director of the Compassion Project.
Thank you all for being here so much, and thank you to the Country Bookshelf for partnering with us on this event to welcome John. Like Jess said, my name is Kate Kaminsky, and I'm the executive director of the Compassion Project in town. Basically, what we've done is we have taught over 6,000 people about compassion in the Gallatin Valley. So about 5,000 of them are K-12 students, and about 1,000 are MSU students, community members that attended workshops, and then every single person that took part in one of our curriculums did 7.5 by 7.5 inch piece of wood art piece. All of those are installed around Bozeman. So there is a 6,000 piece installation around Bozeman in 5 different locations. The Emerson took about 4,500 pieces. So if you can get over there and check that out, it's absolutely beautiful. Red Tractor Pizza, Sola Cafe, Fork and Spoon, and then our installation in the library goes up on May 1st. So we hope you'll come and see those. Each piece has a small little metal tag on it, and that tag is associated with an artist statement that the artist wrote about it. We actually have a mobile app. If you go to the App Store and download the Compassion Project app, you can actually pull up by number what each artist wrote about their statement. So we're really excited to be part of this and to welcome John, who has already been an amazing, gracious person as he has had travel issues the last 24 hours, but we got him here, so be nice to him because he really deserves some compassion after all of that. So without further ado, I would like to welcome John Pavlovitz, an author, writer, activist, and just general amazing human being. So,
all right, so first of all, I apologize if you were expecting me this morning. I was supposed to speak at a church and I got on the plane last night and I remember texting my wife thinking, I feel so relaxed today. And then the pilot came and said, get off the plane. And so we got bumped, and we got bumped until today. And so just made it about an hour ago. So I'm just so glad that you're actually here. I'm honored to be in your presence. You may be here to see me or hear me, but I would actually like to begin by hearing you. I would love to know why you're here. What brought you into this building today? Would someone share with me what brought you here? Yes. You love my political writing. I wasn't aware I wrote political writing. How about that? Thank you. Hi. Okay, yeah, so I got to my house last night and I had to call the pastor and say, you know, tomorrow morning in like 10 hours, I'm not going to be there. So I recorded the best version on my laptop of the message and had they played it today, so it was great. So thank you. I'm glad. Thank you. Why else are you here? Yes, I've helped you get through the last few years. Well, I'm so grateful for that. I am sending a bill for these things, so thank you. This is a perfect partnership for me, and I'm going to share a little bit about my thoughts about compassion shortly. Yes. No, that just means you have to buy everything when you leave.
I'm going to be stalking you.
Okay, so you're a journalist who writes a lot about mental illness and suicide prevention, and that's on my heart. You're probably not aware of that, but I've written several blog posts about my struggle with depression and mental health in the church, because the church was a place as a pastor, as a Christian, that I wasn't really able to share that. I had to kind of conceal that. So I'm so glad you're here. You like my idea about the church of not being horrible? Yes. Yes, and that's happening. This is the church of not being horrible right here. I'm really, honestly, every time I go to a new community, I say, I guess I'm going to be in an empty room today. And then when I'm not, because see, doing the work that I do, I have the data that tells me that people are reading the writing, right? But it's difficult on a daily basis to connect that data to flesh and blood human beings. And so when I walk into a new community and you're here and you're beautiful and you tell me that you're not just bots on my social media profile, it's so encouraging to me, right? And so today is exciting for me. It's exciting because humanity will never be arranged in this specific configuration ever again. We're never all going to share the same space, right? And so what we're going to share in the next few minutes, well, really next 3 hours, I'm having the doors locked, so I'm just wondering. What we share here can actually alter the world outside of this building, and that's hopefully why we're here, right? To change the planet that we live on, the neighborhoods that we're a part of. I'm going to share a little bit about my story. Some of you may know, some of you may not know. For 23 years, well, let me step back. Right now, I'm currently a polarizing public figure talking about faith and politics. And if you're here and your plan is to be a polarizing public figure talking about faith and politics, you need prayer and a better plan, right? Because that wasn't my plan. My plan was not even to be a pastor, but I ended up serving as a local church pastor for 23 years. But I didn't plan that way. Originally, I grew up in Syracuse, New York, in a fairly traditional Italian Roman Catholic family, which means I was raised on gluten and guilt, right? A lot of pasta, a lot of repentance. And, I grew up having stories told to me, stories about a family who was for me, stories about a God who was massive and made everything and yet knew me intimately and loved me completely. And so I grew up having a story of a family who was for me and a God who loved me, but I grew up with some false stories too. I grew up with false stories about people of color. I grew up with false stories about gay people. I grew up with false stories about Muslims. And in all those false stories that I inherited, I was never told specifically, but something in those stories told me I was a little bit more deserving of the love of this great big God than they were. And that's because the people who I was around, the adults, they were only around people who looked and talked and thought and believed and worshiped and loved the way that they did, right? And you know that if you're only around people who look and talk and think and worship and love the way that you do, your table's going to naturally be small. And you're going to rely on false stories for people who don't look and talk and think and believe and worship and love the way that you do. So if I had stayed there in Syracuse, New York, in my little bubble, well, it was a snow globe, right? So, but if I had stayed there, I would have been a decent person, but I would have had far too small a table. And so I got to Philadelphia to study graphic design and illustration, and my world expanded because I was immersed in diversity that I'd never been a part of, and I was surrounded by poverty that I had never experienced, I had never seen. But I was around diversity and poverty, not as intellectual exercises, not as political discussions, not as theological debates. But I experienced diversity, and I experienced poverty through flesh and blood human beings with names and faces and stories that I was now a part of. And those stories started to change me. And you know, if you get truer stories about people, those stories will change you, right? And I can remember going home from my first Thanksgiving break, having a conversation with my father. Now, if you've ever had a revelatory experience and you go to share that experience with people who haven't had it, they don't know what you know, they haven't seen what you've seen, and all of a sudden you do what I was about to do with my dad, which was bulldoze him with my revelation. And we were talking about poor people and why they're poor, let's say. And I said, this is my chance. I'm gonna give him all of the wisdom I've acquired over the past 2 months, you know? So I started sharing all the stuff that I had seen, and I'm getting all, and I, as I'm doing this, there's a voice in my head saying, "You're doing great. Keep going," right? And I said, "Yes, I am." And then I kept going, and my dad started to smile and shake his head. And if you're trying to convince someone of something and they smile and shake their heads, you're doing poorly, right? But he said, "John, you've turned into a real bleeding heart." And I just shot back, "You know, I'd rather have a bleeding heart than a dead one, Dad. And the fact that I'm alive today, right, still here." Means my father was much more compassionate than I gave him credit for. But the truth was, those stories were changing me. And 10 years later, I had gone to a church to be married to my wife. We were married for 3 months. And after the church service, I'm sitting in there thinking very spiritual thoughts, like, I wonder what we're going to eat for lunch today. And I wonder if the Eagles offensive line can handle the Giants defensive pressure. Very spiritual things. And a woman says, "John, I've been thinking about you and praying about you. I think you'd make an amazing youth leader." And I smiled and thought to myself, "I know you. You're the current youth leader." She had paid her debt to society. She had done her time. She was going to get out on good behavior. She needed a victim, a sucker, a minister of the Lord. And so I started volunteering. And the short of it is that my life changed because I ended up with a group of teenagers and realized that I was drawn toward that turbulent time of adolescence, like that really difficult stage of life. I wanted to be present even when other adults didn't want to. I was sort of like a storm chaser. Like, that looks horrible, let's go there, you know? And so what happened was I ended up leaving my career as a graphic designer and to go into full-time ministry. But the more I got into ministry and the further down I walked and the larger the churches got, the more I started to have a conflict between the person I thought I was supposed to be and the pastor that I was expected to be. I started to see how toxic the church was and how small the table of the church could often be. So I started writing about these things, and I decided that I could either take all of the questions that I started having about the church, I could take all the questions about why we treat LGBTQ people this way, I could ask questions about why there are not more female pastors, why the church is not diverse. I could either ask those things or I could hide them. And I decided to lean into those things and talk about them and speak about them and write about them. And I ended up starting at a church in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I tell people that 5 months in, I heard God calling me to leave that church. And it came in the form of my pastor's voice saying, "You're fired." So I like to say it was in my quiet time. It was a voice that sounded like Morgan Freeman. But it was a Thursday and then Starbucks, and the strangers hearing my life fall apart. But the good news is that all of a sudden I could ask anything and I could say everything. All the things I had been learning, all the struggles that I've had, all the questions, I could now just write them openly. And I had this blog. And 3 weeks later, I wrote a blog post called "If I Have Gay Children." And it reached millions of people over the next couple of days. And then it reached many more millions more. And I'm on CNN. And the Ellen Show is calling me. Completely ridiculous, right? And so I wrote this book during that time called The Bigger Table. And that was about how to get disparate people together in spiritual community in a way that we could all be respected. And it was about diversity and authenticity and hospitality and agenda-free relationships. I don't know if you've read it, but it was a joy for me to be a part of that. But I'd like to tell people, I wrote that book in 2015. Good night. No, I wrote this book about differences and about navigating disagreements about important things. And I wish you could have seen me when I wrote that book. Like, I was effervescent. I was bubbly. I believe I looked like a young Brad Pitt. I don't know what happened, right? It's been a long 2 years. But so I wrote this book, but then we had a presidential campaign, and then we had an election, and we've had a presidency. And I'll be honest with you, and most of you know that I am honest. I am now been challenged with how big I actually want the table. That there are people now that I'm having difficulty welcoming for a lot of reasons. But what's happened over the past 2 years as I travel the country, we have a divide in this country, but it's not the one we think. It's not a divide over a president. It's not a divide over a political party. It's not about Senate seats. It's not about election results. It's not about Supreme Court seats. This is about bedrock human being stuff. And that's how this book came to be, because I was talking to a friend after the election and she was crying and she said, "Doesn't anyone remember how to be a decent human being anymore?" And I said, "Well, I don't, but there are people." No, I said to her, a lot of people remember how to be a decent human being. The problem is, in the daily trenches of our lives, it can be difficult to remember, right? We can get distracted. We're on social media, and we're busy, and we're dealing with all sorts of struggles and issues, and we can actually forget why we're here, that why of our lives. But also, we can realize, we can look at the world and say, it really doesn't pay to be a decent human being anymore. Maybe it's fruitless. Maybe it's not worth my time. And so I decided I wanted to write something that was a reminder. And I started to ask a question as I traveled for the past 2 years. The question was, what kind of person does the world need? And the answers, there was so much commonality in those answers, regardless of political affiliation or religious tradition. People were saying people of compassion. We need people of compassion. We need honest people. We need generous people. And so I just started writing and dwelling on those things, those sort of ordinary superpowers. I started to think about the fact that we walk into this day We walk into turbulent days and we try to figure out how to make a difference in the day, right? We all want lives that leave a mark, don't we? We don't want to end up with a life that was inconsequential. And so I started to talk to people about a lifestyle of personal activism. I want you to think about the things in life that burden you. Because that word compassion, it's so beautiful. You may not know this, but the word compassion is strongly tied to the word bowels in their beginnings. And this makes total sense because it was thought long ago that your deepest emotions were housed right there in your gut next to your internal organs, right? Because compassion is that deep internal solidarity with someone, right? When we see their suffering, and it actually makes us physically ill, right? There's actually a phrase that says the bowels are twisted, right? And I want you to think about what twists your bowels, right? What makes you physically ill? I tell people, that's why we say someone's story of suffering moved me, right? So compassion is like a bowel movement. It's beautiful, right? Put that on the banner. That will go well. Hi, I had a bowel movement. Thank you. But see, this is important because as traveling the country, I know that these days people are exhausted, right? You're tired. Most of you, if you have any sort of compassion for humanity, you feel it, right? You feel the fatigue. Put up your hands if you're tired lately. They're even too tired to put up their hands. It's like some, thank you. Yeah. See, the reason why you're tired is because it's exhausting to give a damn. To be a person of compassion in a time and a place when compassion is in such great demand, right? Because you wake up every day and you've got to push back against predatory politicians and toxic systems and human rights atrocities and struggles in your family. And what that does is it can wear you out, right? Because what that does is it accumulates and it resides in your clenched jaw, right? And it resides in your elevated heart rate. It resides in the knot in the pit of your stomach that returns every morning when you check Twitter or you watch the news or you step out into your community or you walk out into your living room. And this is the genesis of Hope and Other Superpowers, because what is at the heart of the book is the idea that you and I, we don't wait for a politician or a religious leader or a celebrity to alter the planet. We have a circle of influence. You have a place where your voice carries. And part of what I love to do with people is just say, whatever kind of person you think the world needs, that's the kind of person I'm asking you to be. Like, the book starts telling about people like Natalie Weaver. And Natalie Weaver is the mom of a young girl. Her first child, Sophia, was born with terrible illnesses and physical deformities. And she started to be an advocate for her daughter, because she realized that the healthcare system was actually going to make it very difficult for her daughter to be sustained and to be cared for. But what Natalie realized was she wasn't just fighting for her daughter, that she had the responsibility and she had the chance to actually do that. So she became an advocate for healthcare, and she is doing such beautiful work in the world. But she said to me, every time I got to a place where I said, I'll do this, but I can't do that, and no one stepped up to do it. And she said, if no one shows up, I will. And so she did, right? This is the story, because you know that this is how this world is altered. This world is renovated not by these big, massive things, not by faraway people. It's changed in the small, in the close, right? Because your life has been changed in the small, in the close. You haven't been changed by an author or a pastor, really. You have been changed by the people who spoke into your life that had a close proximity to you, right? So I'm going to lay my cards out on the table as we set up the idea of Hope and Other Superpowers. I'm a pessimist, or my wife would tell you I'm a pessimist, but I don't like that term. I just like to say I'm prepared for the worst case scenario. I like to be, you know, physically, tangibly, emotionally ready when it all hits the fan. I want to know how bad it can get. And so the election in 2016 was approaching, and I came home one day and I made a declaration. I said, I've got a bad feeling. And my wife said, well, that's what you do. You get bad feelings. It's like profession. It's like spiritual gift of agitation is what you have. I said, no, I'm really feeling like this is not going to go well. And she was giving me the data and the facts. And I said, no, the data and facts are irrelevant at this point. I can feel it, so that's more important. And I said, here's my plan. Election day, I'm going to vote, and then I'm going to take half an Ambien at 8 p.m., and I'm going to go to bed. I said, you have my permission to wake me up if we get the good news. So I voted. I took half an Ambien at 8 p.m., went to bed, and the next thing I know, it was 11:30. I looked at the clock, and I said, oh, no. And I walked out into the office, and I saw her face, and I saw my son, and I went back into the room. because for us, and maybe not for everyone here, but for me and for our family, it began what was a time of profound grieving. Not theoretical grief, not grief that, you know, figuratively, but actually what felt like a loss that something had died. Something maybe of our image of the church, or our idea of family, or our idea of country. And many people have felt that, right? You may have grieved the big things, right? Those big picture things, but you grieve the small and the close. You've grieved what you've seen in your friends. You've grieved what you've seen from your pastors on social media. You've grieved workplace conversations, because this is what we're talking about. The reason we need hope right now is because we're dealing with the relational collateral damage of these days. Because when I walk around, people are not tired only for politics. They're tired because the holiday gatherings are difficult now. They're tired because they're not sure what to do with their spiritual beliefs anymore. And so I want you to lean into that grief. If you are feeling that, if there is unrest in you, realize that that is confirmation that your mind is fully right, that your heart is working properly. It's a reminder that you still have a soul doing what souls are required to do, keep you deeply human and profoundly in humane times, right? So if you are grieving and you have that twisting in your bowels, celebrate it, because you're the kind of person the world needs. Because that's why people are in distress, because they're saying there are no people of love and mercy and compassion left, and you get to say otherwise. I mean, that's a beautiful thing. So lean into that grief. And the second word I want you to think about is gratitude. So I do this compassion fatigue workshop as I travel around the country. I started it for pastors and caregivers, and then everyone started showing up. So we just kept opening it up to more and more people. And I give some tips on how to avoid compassion fatigue. So I've got a list of things that we talk about. One of those is engage and withdraw. Right, you engage and you do the work, but then you withdraw to go to those solitary places and rest and prayer and meditation and silence and solitude. But most people are just engaging, right? And we talk about the power of community, how it's medicinal, how to get into community. And we talked about being creative and following your muses and making sure you're doing all the beautiful things that make life worth living. So I gave this whole list, and a woman said, "John, excuse me, sorry to interrupt, but you forgot something." And I said, "Well, you did interrupt, so please sit down." No, I didn't do that. She said, "You're missing gratitude." And I said, "You don't realize how true a statement that is." For me, sometimes I think I'm gratitude impaired. You know, that I have difficulty. It's not that I'm not deeply thankful for my family. It's not that I'm not grateful for the work that I'm able to do, or that the fact that I'm nearly 50 years old, and when I tell my body to do things, it still obeys me somewhat. There's a conversation, right? But mostly what I'm doing is I'm grateful for it, but I forget to be grateful because I'm so busy trying to change the world that I forget that there is a world that is already worth being grateful for. So let me tell you why this matters. Because you probably showed up here because you're one of the damn givers. Because you're compassionate people. And because you are, you're adept at seeing problems and struggles. You're adept at finding pain. And you're skilled at seeing the world that could be, and so you realize that the world is not what it could be, right? But because of that, it's really easy to forget that there are things worth celebrating right now. So what gratitude does, see, hope is aspirational. Hope is this thing that is going to propel us into days we don't otherwise want to walk into. Hope says, this is not yet here. It's a yet to come. It's a one day soon. We're going to get there. But gratitude says, right now, if nothing changed, there would still be something worth celebrating. So I want you to dwell a little bit on gratitude. I tell the story in the book of a woman named Amy Copeland. I met Amy on Facebook. She went through my newsfeed, and there was a video of Amy. They were talking about Thanksgiving dinner, and when they all go around the room and say what they're thankful for. And Amy said, for elbows. For her right elbow, she was thankful. She said, "I'm thankful for elbows, the way they bring food into our mouths," right? I was like, testify, right? But the truth was, as the screen camera panned out, I realized the gravity of that statement, because Amy was ziplining in Georgia, and the zip line had broken, and she fell onto the rocks of a creek, and she broke her leg. But what happened in that moment was not the bone break, but it was that there was flesh-eating bacteria that had entered her body. And her body started to shut down immediately, and it started to eat away at all her vital organs and her limbs. And she said, "I remember waking up in a drug-induced stupor with my dad holding up the stumps that I had there saying, I need your permission to amputate these to save your life. And so I saw this woman and I said, I need to know her. She's one of the kinds of people the world needs. So I had some mutual friends, contacted her. The next day we're on the phone together and I'm talking about all this. And she said, John, in that moment when my father said, can I take your limbs? She said, I would have let them take everything. I would have been happy to be a head in a jar. That's how much I wanted to live, right? And she said, everything changed for me because now I see everything as fuel for gratitude. And so for you and me, we may not have that big an obstacle, but there are days when we say, this is hard to be grateful, right? But what that gratitude does, it's a superpower that allows us to sit in the present and to be grateful, to be thankful for what's there. And it allows us to be present to people so we can see their pain and we can see the opportunity we have to step into that pain. That's why gratitude is so important, because it focuses you on right here and right now, even in this room. Be here right now, right? I'm a blogger, I'm on social media. So what that means is I save the world a lot. One night, it's just a typical night in our house, and I'm doing what I do. It's 11:30, maybe a little bit earlier, actually, because it was a school night. But I remember working on my computer, and I'm doing this vital, world-saving work. I'm arguing with a stranger on Twitter, right? And I'm typing away, it's like Kermit the Frog meme, right? And then GIF. And my daughter, she's 9 years old, she bounds in the room. Her name is Selah. And she begins firing rapid fire questions at me. And I don't even look up at her. What I do is I keep typing and I say, if I don't look up at her, she's going to take the hint and she's going to know daddy's busy and she's going to stop asking me questions and she's going to leave. But she didn't. Either she didn't realize it or she said, I don't care, right? So then finally she said to me, so I set up a dance party in the next room for you and me. I said, really? And the first thing I thought was, Daddy, I'm arguing with a stranger. This is important, right? And I wanted to keep going and do all the work that I supposed I had to do. And then I just said, wait a minute. Don't blow it, right? And I actually put the computer down and I walked into a room. And there she had all these rainbow strobe lights set up and all her stuffed animals were on the periphery of the room. And we danced, right? And I realized I'm not going to get a lot of more invitations to dance from her. And I was never going to get this one because she didn't want to dance with me later. She wanted to dance with me now. And so we did dance moves. We played on drums. We twirled stuffed animals around. And you know what happened in that moment? I felt my jaw soften. I felt my brow unfurl. I felt my heart rate return to normal in the presence of joy that could not be denied. And what gratitude does is allows us not to miss the life that we have currently in progress. I want you to be an activist. I want you to save the world. I want you to go and do all the things that follow all the burdens that you have, but I don't want you to miss the people closest to you because you will regret it, right? And so I didn't miss the chance to dance and I don't want you to either. So grief, lean into the grief, because where the burden is, that's where your work is. And gratitude, where is the beauty in the world? Because that is going to sustain you. And so let's talk a little bit about hope. You know, hope is that thing that makes you go, this looks really bad, but that's the but. Hope is the but that propels you into the day, right? You ever do that? You get up. This is what I do. I wake up and I forget to be upset. Like I wake up and I say, oh, darn it. I'm supposed to be furious. Or you go, you know what, life's really good. And then what happens is you check Twitter and you go, oh, this is a whole S storm. And then, so you get overwhelmed. There's this phrase, Augustine of Hippo says that hope has two beautiful daughters. Their names are anger and courage. Anger at the way things are and courage to see that they do not remain as they are. You got any problem with the anger? That comes easily, right? We don't have to work at that. But the courage is the different part. And what hope is the courage that says, I'm going to walk into this world and alter this place, and it's going to be somewhat uncomfortable for me. And what I start to do is I tell people, if you want to bring hope into the world, become an activist as lifestyle. But here's the thing, your activism doesn't have to look like anyone else's activism. You don't have to be a jerk blogger. That job is taken. Stay out of my territory, right? But I want you to find a way of following the burden, following the twisting of your bowels, and in a way that looks and feels like you. And I want to give you a couple of quick suggestions. Your ordinary activism, like many of the people in this book, is just stepping into the people whose lives you know and saying what you think needs to be said and doing what needs to be done. So right now, family conversations are difficult. Yes? Maybe? Maybe it's just my family. But I tell people, what people say to me is, John, I can't do this anymore. I can't have this conversation again. And I said, you know what your activism might be? It might be having it again. Because you may be the only voice speaking that in their lives. And there are vulnerable people, there are marginalized people, there are oppressed people, there are people under duress that need you to stay there and speak that. And maybe the one time that you go back and say those hard words again, maybe you'll find just the right way to say it, or maybe they'll be receptive and they'll hear you. Now, it may go horribly wrong. If it does, let me know. I'll send you a t-shirt, right? But another way you can just be an ordinary activist is they have social media in Bozeman, right? The internet's here, right? Okay, just checking. Yes, we'll get somebody on that if you didn't. But how many of you are on at least one social media platform? Just put up your hand for me. So here's the deal. You have something that I didn't have growing up and most people didn't have growing up. You have a way for hundreds, maybe thousands of people to get whatever message you want them to have. Are you leveraging that in a way that perpetuates mercy and love and compassion and justice and equality? And if it's not, figure out maybe there's a way you can. I was in Missouri, we're doing a Q&A, and this woman comes up to me, sweet woman, she's about 80, and she said, I have a great story for us all. And I said, wonderful, I love a great story. And she said, I have a friend on social media, an old friend, and she started posting something that was really derogatory about people of color. And so I decided I was going to say something right on her wall why I didn't agree with it. And she unfriended me. I said, lady, I don't know if you know how great stories work, but that was not one. So we're all depressed here. But she said, no, right before that, one of our mutual friends friend requested me. And I said, yes. And so this woman messaged me and said, well, I'm a Christian and I've lost my faith because I don't feel like there are Christians who are still compassionate people. And she said, seeing your post on my friend's wall reminded me. And I wanted you to know that it kept me going today. So this is the power that you have. It's not just the conversation you're having with a person. It's the multitude of people who are listening in. And that's true of social media or at work or in your families. Keep speaking. Now, it may go horribly wrong. That's two t-shirts I owe you if you're keeping track, right? But I want you to find a way to do the work that needs to be done right now, because all the people in this book, what they said was, I see a gap in the world of generosity, so I'm going to fill that gap with generosity. I see a gap in the world of kindness, so I'm going to create a mechanism to perpetuate kindness. That's what the Compassion Project is, right? People who said, there are more people need empathy in this world because there is a poverty of empathy, so we're going to put some into circulation. So I was at a church in Raleigh. I went to the parking lot of this church and a little over a year ago, and they were having a memorial for the people who were killed in the Parkland shooting. And I went there because I wanted to be anonymous. I just wanted to be with people who were like-hearted, who cared about the things I care about. And I started walking around, and it was a memorial service, and we were there to lament people who were passed too soon. We were there to talk about a violence that seemed to be increasing. We were there to say, are we doing this again? Are we doing this funeral service again, right? So it was heavy, but there was something else happening. Because as I walked around, I looked at the teenagers there, and middle and high school students had planned the whole event. And they had t-shirts they had designed. They had banners they had made. They were hugging and high-fiving people. And I started to feel something strange. I started to feel a counterintuitive joy in that moment. And I started to realize, you know what? There's something pushing back against the darkness, and I can feel it. It's tangible. And middle and high school students spoke that day. And they spoke powerfully, and they spoke prophetically. And as they spoke, hair on the back of my neck stood upright. I got tears in my eyes because I was thinking, something beautiful is still happening. The dam givers are still at work, right? And this is how we cultivate hope. We keep our eyes open, and we say, I know the dam givers are at work. So they had this service, and one of the young people stood up and he said, I want you to know I'm really happy to be here today. He said, I'm not happy because of why we gather, but I'm happy because I woke up today looking for hope. And then he scanned the crowd and he said, and here you are, right? This is what we do. This is why this book is important to me, because we mine this hope together. This is not, there's this phrase that Martin Luther King has said and many others have said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. The idea is that if we keep going, humanity's going to get better. But we don't wait for that. We are here at this place in time. You are here in Bozeman doing the work that you're doing, living the life that you're living. You are the arc benders. You get to make sure that when you leave this place, it's a little bit more toward equality and diversity and love and justice than when you arrived, right? So I don't know, in my book, A Bigger Table, if you've read it, I talk about this house that I was welcomed to and my friend Rod, and he lives in Santa Rosa, California, house overlooking California wine country, beautiful mansion. And I'm there and he welcomed me. And I wrote in the book that the star of that moment was not the view and it was not the house, but it was the hospitality of my friend. And Rod lost his house in the wildfires this past year. And I got him on the phone that day and he said, John, it was crazy. It was 2:15 in the morning. They woke us up. We had 15 minutes. We saved what we could and we left and the whole place burned down. But he said that phrase, as he talked to me, he didn't realize he said it. He said, we saved what we could. This is what we do. This is what this book is. This is what your life is. You can't change every political outcome, but you can alter some races, can't you? You can't help every church be open and loving to LGBTQ human beings, but you can actually change the church that you're a part of. You can't alter the community in large, but you can alter the place where you're standing. And so here's what I'd like you to do. I want you to leave this place realizing that there is power in your story and there is resonance in your voice. Because when I wrote that blog post that went viral, that's the whole reason that we're here today, somehow that happened from that one group of 700 words. I was on CNN the next day and it said, John Pavlovitz, pastor. And it could have easily said, unemployed and currently despondent, right? I had no campaign, I had no capital, I had no job. All I had were words that meant something to me, the deepest contents of my heart. I put those words into the world and those words did something. Don't think that you're not capable of this. This is what the book is about. It's not about changing the world. It's about changing the small portion of it you happen to be standing on in any given moment, right? So given that, what's on your mind? What are you thinking about? I want to take some questions, thoughts, that I can be in a community of people and share those things, the lighter that load is going to be. No one is grieving what you grieve, but I'll guarantee you, everyone in this room is carrying some loss, right? Right after my dad died, I just wrote about this. I was in the grocery store a half hour after that phone call getting bananas. And I remember saying to myself, your dad just died. Why are you buying bananas? And I said, because we need bananas and breakfast is still going to come tomorrow morning and it's not going to bring your dad back if you just stay home. So go get bananas. And part of it has been the process of realizing that's what we do. We keep going in the face of the loss. You never get over the loss. You never shake these things. And what compounds it for many of you in this room probably, remember I said the election, it was a form of grieving. The way normal grief works is we lose someone we love one time and we process that loss for the rest of our lives. What we have now is largely a continual grief. It's a perpetual loss because we wake up every day, there's something else. So part of it is realizing we never get a chance to actually sit with any of the grief. So I would just say to sit with your grief and celebrate it. For me, it sounds trite, but I've always seen grief is the tax on loving people or loving animals. And my bond with my father is the fierceness by which I grieve. So, yes.
Lord Maitreya, one of the Buddha's means loving kindness. Now, as most people know, the foundational principle of Buddhism is non-attachment. It means not having expectations, saying it is what it is. So anything that passes the perception of a tame Buddha, whether it be an ant or a dominating politician, is supposed to be met with loving kindness. Now, have you met any person where you have found you draw the line to dole out compassion, whether it be a child molester or a murderer?
The list I have is too long for us right now. But here's what I will say. Yeah, I wrote that book, A Bigger Table, because I had gotten really good at preaching to a group of Christians, a specific group of Christians, and I said to these group of Christians, let's say they're over here, and I said, you need to treat people like Jesus, people who believe differently than you do, who live differently than you do, you have to treat them with love and mercy, because that's what Jesus had done. Jesus opened up his table to everyone, to priest and to prostitute, to the religious elite and the street rabble. And now those people are saying, are you going to open up your table to me? And I'm saying, that wasn't for me, that was for you. I'm a prophet to you, to me, I'm just a jerk. But what I found was that I have the most difficult time showing compassion for people who seem to have no compassion, right? And so I have to realize that is one of the places I have to lean into. So I'm seeing him all the time. And part of it is because in days like these, to open my table up to one person, let's say the person is a Southern Baptist sign guy, like I talk about in the book, and he believes that gay people are going to hell simply because of who they are and how they love. To try to keep the table open to him, or to try to show compassion toward him, ultimately can send a message to a teenage transgender person who says, John, you're showing love to my oppressor. So the tension point is always going to be, I'm always going to lean toward people who are historically marginalized or historically vulnerable, and I'm going to, because they are the ones who have had less time feeling compassion. But it's a challenge every day, for sure.
There's two issues in the people in my life who are Trump supporters.
It's the orange elephant in the room.
Yes. And it's in Montana. It might not be in Raleigh, North Carolina, but in Montana, one of them is gun control. Mm. And in my family, that's a biggie.
Yeah.
And the other one is abortion. How do you talk about that?
How do I talk about abortion? For me, it's the idea that I have to help people understand that to be pro-life is the phrase that someone will use, and I'll say, can we just take those words and rephrase them? Could we say for humanity? If you're pro-life, you should be for humanity, right? So is it for humanity to not want people fleeing genocide to have safe refuge? Is it for humanity not to want to have people to have health care? So I try to begin to help them understand the wider concept of what humanity is. And usually the problem is most of the things that we were dealing with in those cases, they have been steeped in a religion that is so toxic that they can't see it beyond the words. So you have to try to break the words down. You know, Christians always say, what do you think Jesus was doing when he was healing the leper? And how do you think we should apply that knowledge of healthcare to other people? Should we withhold healthcare? Did Jesus, the great physician, withhold healthcare? I try to meet them where they live in that theological place, but that takes a lot of work. And what I found is I'm often arguing with their idea of God, and if I'm arguing with God, I probably can't win in their minds, right?
Montana's a conservative state. I come from the second most conservative county in the state, Richland County, which votes about 80% red. It's been different a little bit my whole life, but I think in addition to all of the things you've mentioned, one of the things that just really gets me is apathy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so frustrated with apathy. So I see people that I know are compassionate, but they're just apathetic about it. Do you have any thoughts on apathy?
Yeah, one of the things is I learned is that I can't argue someone into feeling compassion, and it bothers me because I want to be able to. I want to be able to craft words that can get people to care. You're a damn giver, you just do. Part of it is trying to make sure that you tell people's stories a lot, because that's what changed me. Truer stories about people in Philadelphia, that whole experience, I didn't wake up one day and think, I'm going to care about people. It's just when you step into those stories, it starts to change you. What many people are dealing with is apathy, but it's part of it's embarrassment. They may have voted a certain way and now they're thinking, oh, I'm not sure about that. I don't like that at all. But they can't say it, because to say that is to put them in conflict with their family, their church. So a lot of it isn't just apathy. It's fear. It's regret, all these things. And so part of it is trying to encourage people by being as loud as you can about the things you care about. Because remember that woman? She said, I just saw this complete stranger. And that person said, made her say, oh, I should keep going. The things I'm saying are not revelatory. The things I've been writing about, I've only just decided that when you put those words out into the world, those words are going to do a work that nothing else can do, and it works that way with our lives. But apathetic people are, as a Christian, the deepest source of grief for me right now. I've got thousands of people. I've been in a mega church for 10 years before the smaller church where I was released. But for 23 years in churches, I have thousands of Christians I know on social media, and they've slowly either disconnected or I've seen them become silent. And I realize, I know what you know. I know what message you've heard preached. I know the mission trips we went on to those countries. Like, I know when you've had life-changing experiences with people that now you're callous toward. So we just have to do the work where we are. You've got some people who may listen to you. Nudge them out of their apathy. Invite them to do something. I have one friend, she invites people to her home. Her activism is she has parties with people she disagrees with. Now, I'm not going to that. Hey, let's argue. No, thank you. I'll send a gift basket. But here's why this is important, because every week she meets with these people, she plays cards with them, and they have dinners together, and she said, I see slowly cracks in what they used to be just stereotypes in their minds. I'm helping them see differently. But one of the women said this the other day. She said they were talking about the racism in our country, and the woman got quiet, and she said, I just don't understand that. And my friend said, what? And she said, I don't understand why God made other races. She said, because if God hadn't made other races, we'd all get along and we wouldn't have this problem. But did you hear with a bias in her? She thought her whiteness was the baseline. Other races were non-white. And so she now has to peel through that. But it's only in that authentic relationship that she could even hear that. So your activism, your world saving may be across a dinner table. I had to tell her, you know, if Adam and Eve existed, they weren't white, and the cradle of civilization did not have a Cracker Barrel, right? So, yes.
So you mentioned these thousands of Christians over the 23 years.
Yes.
I don't know quite how to phrase it, but is it something you've seen just conditioning over the last X number of years, you know, diverging from a path, or is there...
Well, you mean, have I seen Christians, like, I know, get worse, or...
Yeah, or
that. No, well, here's what happens. In the church, like in many places, there is stuff that we feel that we don't say. And the way I explain it was, if you were an activist or you really cared about issues of race, you know that nothing new happened in 2016, right? If you were tied, if you understand homophobia or misogyny, Trump didn't invent those. All he did was uncover them. Because when you have someone at the highest level open about those things, it gives everyone else permission to show their junk. So that's what Christians have done. They've said, oh, I always had these kind of thoughts, especially in North Carolina, like we have the people with Confederate flags. All of a sudden they go, oh, I can just fly that. What? It's just been an emboldening. I always tell people, like people who are activists, you were looking at the world with an X-ray, so you saw it, even though people thought it was fine. Now we've got a compound fracture. Now the bone is through the skin and we're going, okay, this is a problem. And now it's an opportunity for us. That's where the hope is.
You had 2 minutes with the president, what would you say?
I'd say Hillary. I don't think I would say anything. I would affirm other people in his presence. I don't think he can be argued into. I think when someone is in that place of such malevolence and brokenness, the only thing I can try to do is show them something else. I would try to affirm the people that I love. What I tell people is the work that I do, I don't argue with the bully to try to change the bully, but I want the bullied people to know that they're worth speaking up for. So I don't know if there's anything that could be said to him. What we have to do is I want to talk with the people who I see who have abandoned key parts of themselves in the past 2 or 3 years. Those are the people I want to talk to. Someone said to me, John, are people beyond help or beyond reaching? I said, some people are, but some people aren't, or some people will be reachable in 2 or 3 years, right? Because you don't always believe what you believe now. Your politics are not what they always were, your theology. We have to give people time to wake up and see the things that we already see, right? Yes, in the back.
From your experience and your work, what do you believe has been or will be most powerful about initiatives like the Compassion Project that Tia and Kate have invested so much in our community?
I think what I have tried to figure out to do with people who are progressive, people who are maybe left-leaning. Someone said to me, why does the Christian right have Franklin Graham and Jerry Falwell, and we don't have anyone. And I think it ties into that we're still, I think, progressives are doing events, things, days, marches. We've got to figure out now how to take those things and let them be a catalyst for something ongoing. So I'd love to see the work that we're doing in the world to figure out how to do it together. I was part of a group called Common Good Christians, and I was just invited to do an event, and I said, I like it, but you know there are common good Muslims and common good atheists and common good cosplayers. And so let's get all the people of the common good together and figure out what can we do past an experience. So I'd like to see us figure out how to engage the church and the political world and transcend those things. Tomorrow night, I'm going to be pushing people to say, after this, this should be a launching pad, not a landing pad, right? And I know that that's what the organizers, that's what we're about. Yes?
Are you endorsing any particular presidential candidates at this time?
I'm not decided whether or not I'm going to run, so I have to wait. No, it's a little early. I'm committed to anyone that stops fascism, which would be any of them. Honestly, in my mind, I haven't gotten there yet. There's like 1,000 candidates now. Like, anyone else don't want to announce their run today? So
are you currently a part of a faith community? And if not, why have you chosen not to?
Yeah, well, I have a home church. It's in North Raleigh. The only reason I'm not on staff there is because when the first book came out, about 5 months before, my pastor said at a staff meeting, here's what I think is going to happen. John's going to release his book, and they're going to want him to travel around the country, so we're going to have to make a plan and figure out what to do. And I thought, well, I'm just going to probably do 1 or 2 days. Well, it's 2 years later, and so we just slowly offloaded my stuff. But yeah, that's our home church, and when I'm there, I travel probably 3 weekends a month, so I can't be on staff. It's just irresponsible. But yeah, so I'm part of a local faith community and as well a Unitarian community in Raleigh. I speak at probably every 6 weeks or so. I'm still trying to figure out how to do it. If I were there every week, would I still be a pastor? I don't know. I've found that this is a way that I can foster community in just a very different way.
I'm a retired teacher. I taught ancient world history to seventh graders. And I think Montana is not a crossroads. And so diversity is hard for the kids who are not really. We do have some movements of a sister city connections with Japan. And we have Native American, like seven major reservations in Montana. But, you know, kids don't have a lot of diversity to relate to. And I found that in my classes, simply looking, you know, as in ancient world history, you have to expose to the major civilizations and positive beliefs to show that there's so many people in different arenas striving for good, however it's expressed. And education cannot be underestimated as a place to at least positive role models, looking at people who have made a difference.
That's right.
Gandhi say, if you want to be the change, you know, that you want in the world. But I remember a student coming to me, and she said, she confessed to me, my father's really a racist. And I said, well, honey, you know, the conflict in young people is, I mean, they can see.
Yes.
They're intelligent beings.
Yes.
And they may have some things that they're disturbed about or ashamed about in their families. But, you know, the cautionary thing is that love your dad, love your father, but just know that you will grow up and you'll make your own choices.
Yeah.
Because it is a conflict to love someone who is in that.
Oh, for sure.
Or that anger. That exclusion. And so, you know, I mean, it is increment by increment, day by day, moment by moment. Educate and expose.
Yeah, and it's, I used to tell teenagers all the time, your life is 90% controlled by your parents just because of where you can go and what you have to do. And I said, that's healthy, but sooner or later, you're going to have more ownership of it. And when you get more ownership, you can be more of who you are, or you can explore that, and then you won't be, you know, part of it's having them embrace that. So one day you'll be 100% you. But it is hard because it's not just that. I have people tell me all the time, A woman on Instagram said the other day, my 37-year-old marriage just ended because of what I've seen in my husband over the past 2 years. We finally couldn't reconcile it. But this is why it's one thing for me. I've been released from a church, so I can say whatever I want. But I know the reality is then we have our families across the table from us, and we know them, we love them. It's really easy just to cut them off, right? One of the last things I'll share with you is I had a teacher in art school, and he said, this is an ordinary still life that you're about to draw. It's things that you see all the time. It's things that people walk past, they no longer notice it. And he said, what you have to do, if you want to show them the beauty of things that they no longer see, you have to become a student of what you draw. He said, you have to look at the shape of it and what it's made of and think about its color and its texture, and you have to really sit with it. Then you can show the beauty of it. And so we have to become students of people. We have to realize they didn't just show up with some ideology. They have a history. And I think that's really helpful with our families. Well,
the other thing is that with the maturity of not to react with militancy and fanaticism yourself.
Right. And then teenagers are not into that anyway. So it's...
It's a skill. It's maturity. And it's not always there.
Well, I missed the flight last night, but I made it here. And the great thing is, it's awesome because I woke up today looking for Hope Bozeman, and here you are, right? So thank you. I so appreciate your time.
You have been listening to a talk given by John Pavlovitz, recorded at the Country Bookshelf on April 14th, 2019. In a talk that was part of a series of public events in Bozeman organized by MSU's The Compassion Project. John Pavlovitz's latest book is Hope and Other Superpowers, published by Simon & Schuster. You can find out more about the Compassion Project at their website, www.montana.edu/The Compassion Project. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LaClaire for Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of this station's staff, underwriters, or board of directors.